Maybe you've run across someone who challenges the veracity of the heart and center of the Christian faith, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and they come armed with a genuine bona fide legend from the past. You can actually find this thing. Apollonius of Tyana. He did miracles. According to the legend, he rose from the dead. And it is, your friend might say, all legend and myth. And for that matter, so is all that nonsense about Jesus. He did miracles. He supposedly rose from the dead. But it's just as much a myth as Apollonius of Tyana. How do you respond? Is there a response to this? And what do you do with the accounts, the mythic accounts of miracle workers and those who have risen from the dead? We're going to be talking about that here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Gretchen Passantino will be our guest from Answers in Action. A little later in this hour, Marianne Hackett of Illinois Right to Life will join us. We're going to talk about the battle in the Illinois Senate that has come to a halt over stem cell research. An unexpected roll call vote meant the end of a bill on cloning, and we'll find out whether that's good news or bad news from Marianne Hackett a little later in this hour. We've got open lines in the second hour, or a little bit in the first hour, a little bit in the second hour, overlapping the break there. There are two candidates, and I want your answer to this question, so start thinking about it now in preparation for open lines a little bit later, all right? Here's the question. I need your answer to it during open lines. Two candidates. Candidate A, he is a pro-life, anti-homosexual Republican. He's a Muslim. Now, that's not at all unlikely, is it? No, it's not at all unlikely. Pro-life, anti-homosexual Republican who is a Muslim. Candidate B, he is a pro-choice, pro-homosexual Republican who's a Christian. We find these all over the place, don't we? How about Rudolph Giuliani? Pro-choice, pro-homosexual, he's a Republican, he's a Christian. Who do you vote for, candidate A or candidate B? I want your answer to that question during open lines in the second hour of Issues, etc. Then after open lines, we're going to spend some time talking with Pastor Joe Goodell. How can the Hadith, those traditions about Muhammad's sayings and actions, how can the Hadith be a bridge when you witness to a Muslim? A bridge in order to share the gospel with the Muslim. Pastor Joe Goodell, author of an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Using the Quran and the Hadith as a Bridge for Sharing the Gospel, will answer that question in the second hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Dan Gard joins us to talk about ministry to soldiers in the third hour. And this is a time when we need some ministry to soldiers, don't we? And then we'll round off by talking with Terry Mattingly about the religious left. He's written two columns that bear upon that subject in his regular column for Scripps Howard News Service called On Religion. Terry will join us in the very last part of Issues, Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Gretchen Passantino is co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California. She's authored an article in the latest Answers in Action newsletter titled Apollonius of Tyana, a Rival to Christ. Gretchen, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.
Tell us who Apollonius, at least according to legend, was and what he did.
Well, you know, according to legend, and it's a little difficult to find out because there's not very much written on him, not too many people know too much about him, we don't have much surviving about him, but according to legend, he was a prophet, he was a miracle worker, he rose from the dead. His followers claimed that he was representing God or was an appearance of God. And in fact, in the third century, we even have a record of a minor ruler's wife wanting to start a cult around him. Now, there are people who take this very little bit that we can know about him, and none of it's, you know, from his actual lifetime or from eyewitnesses, and they say, well, he's just like Jesus. It's interesting. It reminds me of when I was a little kid. There was a little kind of a nursery rhyme that my mother used to read to me. It was about best friends. And it goes something like this. If she were a little bit taller and I were a little bit shorter. If she were a little bit wider and I were a little bit thinner. if her hair were longer and mine were a little shorter, if her hair were a little darker and mine were a little lighter, if her eyes were blue and my eyes were blue, et cetera, the poem goes, then we'd be just like twins. That's about how Apollonius of Tyana and Jesus Christ are. Nothing in common, but if you just changed each one of them to be just like the other, they'd be just like each other.
Okay, I want you to answer what seems to me the most obvious jab that would be taken at a Christian who believes in the resurrection of Jesus Christ using Apollonius. And that is this one. And of course, it may or may not have any historic merit whatsoever, but someone says, well, how do we know that the disciples of Jesus, enamored with their master as they were after his tragic and unexpected death, didn't just pick up one of these common plot lines, stories that were floating all over the ancient world about miracle workers who rise from the dead and apply it to
Jesus? Oh, my gosh, you've got like five things I disagree with so far, but go ahead.
Well,
get to your
that's
point.
It. How do we know they just didn't pick this up and apply it to Jesus?
Good point, and I would far rather have somebody ask me the question, how do we know this didn't happen, than to just make the statement, this is what happened, because it really isn't what happened. As a matter of fact, the idea of actual resurrection, that is, the same body that died being brought back to life again, never to die again, is a uniquely Christian idea. Now, there were fertility myths and seasonal myths that had to do with, you know, a seed dying and bearing fruit, with the sun going away, with the short days of winter, and then coming back with the lengthening days of spring, with plants dying and decomposing and providing fertilizer for new plants, with the idea that the gods could change forms and go from a material form to a spiritual form, or that the power of one being could be transferred to the to another being. But the idea of bodily, physical resurrection as an historical act, as an event regarding a particular physical, material, human individual, is unique to Christianity. So, for example, with Apollonius of Tyana, his quote-unquote resurrection is just some stories about miracles that were performed in his name or by his power after his death. Nothing about a physical resurrection, nothing about a bodily resurrection, nothing about an empty tomb, nothing about eyewitnesses. Another thing is that, you know, you had said that in the way it's commonly posited, these stories were floating all around the Mediterranean at the time. They weren't. As I said, bodily resurrection was a uniquely Christian idea, but also there were very few other stories like this. As a matter of fact, the skeptic who uses Apollonius of Tyana as an example or as a counterexample to Jesus has to really search and scratch within 300 years after Jesus to come up with someone who is even remotely similar. You don't have stories of bodily resurrection, empty tomb, eyewitness testimony from anybody but the Christians. And the disciples themselves were not expecting this or understanding it. In John chapter 2, John quotes Jesus talking about how he would raise himself from the dead in 3 days. And John says, but his disciples didn't understand what he was saying. Therefore, when he was raised from the dead, then they remembered what he said, and they understood it. And so it's not that the disciples were looking for something like this or that they desired for something like this to have happened, and so they made it up. They weren't expecting it. They didn't think it would happen, and it was a surprise to them. They were confronted by the facts.
So we're really talking about the quality of the claims, comparing the quality of the claims and the evidence therein.
Exactly. In fact, probably 10 or 15 years ago, an atheist brought this up the first time my husband Bob and I heard of this. It was 10 or 15 years ago. And my late husband Bob had a really great wit about him. I'm sure it's much sharper now that he's with the Lord. But anyway, the person asked him, you know, this real badgering question of about Apollonia of Tyana, and, he had just as good credentials as Jesus Christ, and you don't see people starting a religion around him. And Bob, who had never heard of the guy before, he's an extremely obscure figure, you know, a bare footnote in ancient history, looked at the guy and said, well, gee, I wonder why it is we don't see a whole religion around him. Maybe there's something about his claims that are not the same as Jesus's. What would it take to get a whole religion around somebody's story? Probably take a lot more than what Apollonius of Tyana had to offer. Now, since then, of course, we've researched the subject and we know quite a lot more about it. And, that supposition that Bob had was verified. But one of the strongest arguments against comparing to Apollonius of Tyana to Jesus Christ is that there is no world religion that's changed human history following Apollonius of Tyana, but there is following Jesus Christ of Nazareth.
What about anything from the contemporaries of Apollonius? Is there anything there for us to look at?
No, we have absolutely nothing from his contemporaries. The closest we have is we have some citations about him from the 3rd century, roughly 150 years after his time period, that were written by people who said they were trying to gather the stories that were going on, that were going around about him. But other than a very short section that refers to his prophetic ability and his fascination with astrology, we really can't know that anything was written down about him until at least 150 years after his life. And even that small fragment, we're only supposing that because it sounds well organized and grammatically balanced, that may be not merely writing down an oral tradition, but writing down something that had been written before.
And
so we really have nothing from the contemporaries.
And for Jesus?
For Jesus, we have so much eyewitness testimony about Jesus. We have, in fact, the 11 disciples. We have the Apostle Paul. We have the brother of Jesus, James, and both Paul and James were not believers when they saw the resurrection. We have the Marys and Martha. We have the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. We have over 500 people at one time, Paul says, who saw him. And when Paul was writing this in 1 Corinthians 15 in the mid-50s, which was less than 20 years after Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, Paul said that most of those 500 people were still alive. Now, how would he know they were still alive unless somebody was keeping track of them? They were available to give eyewitness testimony. We also have an eyewitness silent testimony that I think is very, very important. You know, people will say that an argument from silence is an informal fallacy, that you can't believe it. Just because I don't say that I don't beat my dog doesn't mean that I don't beat my dog. I could beat my dog and not tell anybody about it. That's an argument from silence. You can't accuse me of being a dog beater just because I don't deny it. But there is a significant silence that I think can tell us something in along with other evidence, and that is, at the time of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, and the beginning movement of Christianity, the disciples were going around telling everybody that he rose from the dead, that the tomb was empty. The Jews and the Romans, who had every reason to not be silent and instead to speak out, to produce the tomb, to produce the body, did not. As a matter of fact, they agreed that the tomb was empty. They just gave different explanations for it. So even the opposers to Christianity, the Romans and the Jews, could not dispute the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
What about written material that falls within a century of the events? Compare Apollonius and Jesus Christ.
Well, even the most liberal scholars will agree that portions of what we have as the New Testament today were composed within 20 years of the events of Jesus' ministry, including his resurrection. That is absolutely too short a time for myths or unsubstantiated great feats of heroicism, bravery, or miracles to be inserted without dispute. As a matter of fact, I believe that good, careful scholarship can show that the vast majority of the New Testament was completed before A.D. 70, which would have been within 40 years of the events. And, in fact, I happen to believe that the whole New Testament, including the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation, were written before A.D. 70. But having said that, we have abundant eyewitness testimony and written testimony from within the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses. If the written testimonies are within the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses, then it is impossible for there to have been enough time for myth or false stories to grow up and to be assumed to be substantiated when the eyewitnesses were still there who could repudiate it.
Let's talk about the corroboration of the alleged miracles on the part of Apollonius and the corroboration of the miracles of Jesus.
Well, with Apollonius, you have no corroboration of any of his alleged miracles. All you have is an attempt by a 4th century, that's 300s, a 4th century court hanger-on named Philostratus, who reconstructs some miracle accounts 120 years after Apollonius' death. Now, Philostratus was working for a court in the Middle East in an area that today we would know as contemporary Syria. And the wife of the local leader was fascinated by Apollonius, partly because of her fascination with astrology, that Apollonius was notorious for being good at astrology. And he wanted to get in her good graces. Mostly, he wanted her husband's money so he wouldn't have to get a real job. So he volunteered to go around and collect all the information he could find about Apollonius and develop a text of Apollonius so that this wife of this minor ruler, could build a whole astrology cult around herself using Apollonius as their chief figure. And so that's what he did. He was a partisan, hired to do the job, had it in his best interest to produce a document that would impress this woman, and in fact, that's what he did. And yet, his accounts, we have no evidence that any of those were written until more than 120 years after his death. We have no eyewitness testimony. We have no people saying, well, we in Christianity, we have testimony from one of the earliest of the church fathers in the early 100s that he had gone around and he had interviewed some people who had still been alive during Jesus' ministry, and they had been raised from the dead or healed. And he interviewed them and verified that what they had told the apostles so many years before when the New Testament was being written was in fact the truth, and it had actually happened to them. So we have that continuity of testimony of the eyewitnesses for Christianity. We have no continuity of testimony and no eyewitnesses to the supposed miracles of Apollonius.
So the picture here is emerging, folks, that with Apollonius of Tyana, a man who allegedly did miracles and rose from the dead, it's a very thin thread upon which the whole tale hangs, whereas with Jesus Christ, not a thin thread, but a rather stout rope of evidence, of corroboration, of history there. We're talking with Gretchen Pasentino, co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California, author of an article in the latest Answers in Action newsletter titled Apollonius of Tyana, a Rival to Christ. Gretchen, Jesus' followers, after his resurrection and his ascension, also perform miracles to corroborate or to confirm their testimony about Christ's resurrection. That was the whole purpose of the miracles. Do the followers of Apollonius, early or late, ever have anything like this happen?
No, there are no miracles associated with followers of Apollonius either during his lifetime or later on when this little cult was devised by the minor ruler's wife in the 4th century. As a matter of fact, we don't have any evidence that there were followers of Apollonius during his lifetime. We know that he taught. We know that he wrote. We know that he went around the countryside gathering crowds around him and expressing to them his esoteric ideas, many of which were contradictory about philosophy and religion and life. But we have no evidence that he organized followers or that he began even like a philosophical school or a religious center or anything like that. In the 4th century, we have this minor cult started by this minor ruler's wife that only lasted a few years of her lifetime, didn't even succeed her lifetime, much less that of Apollonius. And mostly they were people who wanted to sit and listen to his teachings and his ideas. They didn't go out and start orphanages and hospitals like the Christians did. They didn't go out preaching to the whole world. They didn't go out making converts, and they certainly didn't do any miracles. And yet we see with the apostles that, it, just as Jesus promised, the very miracles that he did to authenticate his ministry, they did to authenticate their ministry. And their ministry was about the one who produced all the miracles, Jesus Christ, who was God in the flesh. Apollonius supposedly earned the right to become deity by his amazing teachings and his life. Jesus Christ was deity, who proved that he was deity by his teachings, his miracles, and his resurrection from the dead.
Finally, so we have a little bit of time to wrap this up and put a bow on it. What about the messages? You talked about Apollonius' esoteric ideas. What about the I guess you could say, the internal consistency of the messages of Apollonius on the one hand and of Jesus Christ on the other?
Well, you know, many, many years ago, when I first became a Christian, I sacrificed my mind for Jesus. I thought that you had to give up thinking critically and depending on facts and looking at reality in order to be a Christian. You had to just have faith in spite of the evidence. In the 35 years since then, I have learned that that's the exact opposite, that in Christianity, you regain your right mind for the first time in your life, and you can actually think straight, think critically, look at the facts, and have confidence in the evidence. When you look at Apollonius of Tyana, you have to have a suspension of disbelief, and you have to ignore the facts, ignore the fact that his teachings are self-contradictory, and you have to just pick and choose from among the contradictory things he says, those things that appeal to you or tickle your fancy. Many, many years ago, someone confronted me with alleged contradictions in the Bible, and as a brand new Christian, I said, I don't care if it's in the Bible, I believe it. I'll believe it even if it's a contradiction. After 35 years of very carefully and seriously and academically studying the Bible, I have found that there are no contradictions anywhere, Old or New Testament. 66 books, however many authors involved, all the different time periods, places, and perspectives. The Bible is the Word of God. There are no contradictions. Every single thing raised as an alleged contradiction has good, solid evidence and critical thinking that shows that it is not a contradiction. The message of Jesus was completely consistent, never varied, and told us that we were separated from God, but could be redeemed by what Christ did for us on the cross.
With only 30 seconds here, Gretchen, someone says, someone walked up to me, showed me a footnote in a book, Apollonius, miracle worker, supposedly raised from the dead. I feel my faith is shaken. In 30 seconds, your best nutshell response.
I think I would go back to what Bob said so many years ago when we first heard about him. Well, you don't see a religion formed around him, do you? Must be something about his claims that just don't cut the mustard. What is it about Jesus, as Sir Norman Anderson said many years ago, the great historian and Islamic scholar? Christianity is the witness of history. Not merely do we have a religion based in history, but we are the historical proof that that religion has power and transforms life. Nobody follows Apollonius of Tyana. Millions, billions of people follow Jesus Christ of Nazareth.
Folks, you can check out the website for Answers in Action. Just go first to our website, issuesetc.org. There, you will find a link with regular guests. Click on that, scroll down, and you'll find a direct link to Gretchen Pasentino and Answers in Action. The website address again, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Gretchen, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you. It's always a blessing.
Gretchen Pasentino, co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, author of an article in the latest Answers in Action newsletter. You can find out about it at their website through that Links with Regular Guests link at our website. The article's called Apollonius of Tyana, A Rival to Christ. Answer? No. When we come back from this break, Marianne Hackett of Illinois Right to Life will be our guest. Talk about the battle in Illinois Senate over stem cell research. Stay with us.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God? Can someone worship God the Father apart from Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the next edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. It's called Mere Monotheism, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. What's the difference between a knowledge of God and the true worship of God? Find out with the Issues, Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Dr. Leonard Peyton's journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues, Etc., the radio show, you need to get the Issues, Etc. Journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a free copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about a boy in India who was working in a hotel dining room. His name is Avinash, and his boss yelled at him if he moved too slowly and beat him if he didn't do his chores properly. But a man with the Ramabai Mukti Mission, Reverend Wankhede, met Avinash and learned that his father died, his mother ran away, and his grandparents were beggars. Reverend Wankhede met the grandparents, and they agreed to let Avinash and his sister live with other children at the Mukti Mission home. They attend school, have the food they need every day, and they're learning about the Bible and Jesus Christ. Avinash is also sharing Christ's love with his grandfather. Pray that this boy will grow to be a Christian leader in India. Get a free copy of a video, Destination Love, and see the beautiful ways that children in India are having their lives changed. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Matthew 14 says, King Herod had John beheaded in the prison. Searching my feelings on the despicable murder of Nicholas Berg, I found guidance in Jesus' reaction when he heard that John the Baptist had been beheaded. The Bible says when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. The Greek word translated withdrew is instructive. Plato used it for leaving the battlefield, and Thucydides, in similar vein, used it for retreating after a defeat. Jesus is the Almighty Son of God, but a true human being as well. So he felt the heat. One prophet beheaded. Am I next? Jesus retreats to a solitary place. I need to retreat as well. I have to realize anew that there are evil people. I have to understand that civilized people can rationally discuss disagreements, but barbarians cannot. I have to fill out my notion of love with a truth that selfless love can also mean fighting, even killing our enemies, so that we can live quiet and peaceable lives. After Jesus had retreated, he returned to give himself in the battle against evil. Therefore God has highly exalted him, says Philippians 2. No crown without a cross, no victory now without life and death sacrifice.
Hey, 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 hey. You've heard the saying, it's a jungle out there. That's true. But if you're like most of today's families, it's a jungle right here, right now. Find direction with Dr. James Dobson and focus on the family. Straight answers and solid advice for dealing with life in the jungle.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us here for just a few minutes, Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life. We're going to talk about that battle in the Illinois Senate over stem cell research you may have read about in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In 15 minutes, I want your answer to this question. You have two candidates that you could possibly vote for. One is a pro-life, anti-homosexual Republican who is a Muslim. The other candidate is a pro-choice, pro-homosexual Republican, like Rudolph Giuliani, who's a Christian. Who do you vote for? That's the question for you in 15 minutes on Issues Etc. Mary Ann Hackett is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. She joins us to talk about stem cell research in the Senate of the state of Illinois. Mary Ann, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the bill and what became of this bill this week in the Illinois Senate.
Well, apparently there was a surprise roll call vote, and of course we're delighted because it stopped the march toward cloning and stem cell research in Illinois. But our people down there suspected Jeff Schoenberg will try to put in another amendment. But there's been a real outpouring of letters and calls to the senators, and it seems to me that they were successful in this case by stopping the bill.
Okay, can you sort this out for us? It's a little bit confusing in the Associated Press story. There's the bill, and then there's the Schoenberg amendment.
Right.
What failed
And why are you happy about Illinois Right to Life?
The bill actually was to allow embryonic stem cell research, which, of course, we're against in any case. But also in the bill allowed cloning. Now, they say it isn't cloning. They call it somatic nuclear cell experimentation, but that is... that's actually cloning. It's just another somatic nuclear cell transfer is cloning, and they call it by that to sort of disguise it. And what the bill, the amendment that Jeff Schoenberg tried to add, was to prohibit bringing the clone to birth, but it didn't prohibit growing it to the period of 8 weeks and using it for experimentation. It was sort of a disguise bill. He pretended his amendment would prohibit cloning in Illinois, which is not true. It's not what it would have done.
What is the status of this kind of research where either through in vitro fertilization, the embryos used there, or in some other means, privately funded, human embryos are conceived, grown, and then killed for the harvesting of their stem cells? What's the status of that kind of research, apart from human cloning in Illinois?
There has been no evidence of any successful results of experiments done with stem cells from embryos. There has been enormous success in the experiments and research with adult stem cells. And it's from blood cord. They can find stem cells in skin, in baby teeth. There's all sorts of sources for stem cells that are not immoral, that do not cause the death of a person in retrieving them, and they have been successful. There's been no successful research with embryonic stem cells. And so they're still pushing for that, and the claim is that the pro-lifers are against stem cell research, which isn't true. We're very supportive of stem cell research that does not require the killing of a human being. And so there isn't a New Jersey passed a very liberal law that allowed cloning as well as the embryonic stem cell. But, you know, President Bush ruled that the only stem cell research could be done were the cells that had already been retrieved. No new ones could be done with federal funds, but that doesn't mean private funding isn't going to be used.
If cloning is cloning, as you have said there, Marianne, no matter what you call it,
right?
Why do the proponents of the bill, of the amendment that was put in there, why do they want to maintain the false distinction between so-called reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning?
Well, because the majority of the people in our country are opposed to cloning. They think it's an immoral thing. They think it's wrong. And so in order to get it through in their legislation, they call it something else. And, in fact, it is the same thing. It isn't something else. It is cloning. And I think people need to understand that you scientifically you can call things by different names. A good example of that is the partial birth abortion. The medical profession said there is no such thing as partial birth abortion. They called it by a different name, you know, but the fact of the matter is the result was exactly the same and the method was exactly the same. So this is an effort because of the public outcry and the public opinion against cloning to call it by another name and slip it in without people knowing it. They call it somatic cell nuclear transplantation, and that is cloning.
How do you respond to the proponents of this bill, such as, quoted in the Associated Press story, John Kessler, chairman of neurology at Northwestern University Medical School? He says it's a matter of dollars into Illinois, research dollars into Illinois. Quote, a lot of young scientists would like to go into stem cell biology, but are not certain that they'll be able to receive the financial help to do their work. How do you respond?
Well, I don't think the human life is debatable in terms of dollars and cents, and I think there's plenty of other research that's being done that someone could go into, someone could choose it as a career, and it would bring money into the state. But why does it have to be only the type of research that kills a human being? You know, personally, I believe that this is all part of trashing the babies. When it's very obvious that other successful research is done on adult stem cells and other methods of retrieving cells that don't harm a human being, they insist that it's got to be embryonic, and I think it's a matter of treating the unborn baby as a human part factory, extra parts, and that it can be killed, that it has no value on its own, whereas we don't believe that. We believe every human being has the right to life and has a value because they're made in the image of God.
So, Marianne, if the voters are willing to support something that would basically be a clone and a kill bill that would require the products of the cloning, the human embryo, to be destroyed so that stem cells could be retrieved, is that a very big jump in your mind from saying, well, rather than stopping at 10 or 14 days, let's push on to 3 or 4 months, and then we could not only harvest stem cells, we could also harvest organs?
Well, that's right. But and actually, this bill did allow growing an embryo or even a cloned embryo to 8 weeks when it becomes no longer an embryo but a fetus. But, you know, they don't grow embryos to 8 weeks in a petri dish. They have to be implanted to grow. And it will become, I think, a marketing thing. It will be, they will pay women to carry the embryos, and then, of course, they'll perform an abortion, a live birth abortion, so they can retrieve the parts and the cells. People don't like to think about those things. There's a lot of things, you know, we can do in medical science and in research. The argument here is, should we do them? Are they immoral? Are they an affront to the humanity and dignity of human beings? And they are. And I think people need to be educated and not fall for this sleight of hand by calling it a different name.
Two final questions.
Okay.
What are the chances of a total ban on all cloning in Illinois passing through the House and Senate and getting a governor's signature?
Well, I think if the people are educated, there's a good chance that something like that could be passed, because the polls show that the American people are opposed to cloning. And so I think if a real educational campaign is initiated and people understand what's involved here, I think it could pass. But it's going to take an educational process. And I think because of the trying to call things by different names and deceive the people, the education has to be clear, strong, intensive, and upfront so people understand what we're talking about.
Finally, why should Illinoisans make the case? Why should Illinoisans oppose embryonic stem cell research?
Because it kills a human being. That's the simple reason, that we can't treat human beings as spare parts, that we have to treat them with the dignity and humanity that they have just because they are human beings. And they should oppose it with all they can, because there are other methods of curing people. Our hearts go out to anybody that has these terrible diseases, Parkinson's, diabetes, all sorts of diseases that they claim can be cured with stem cells. But the real research and the real successes are in adult stem cells.
Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. Marianne, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be with you, Todd.
That's Marianne Hackett. Now, you can go to the website for Illinois Right to Life and visit them, get more information, I'm sure, on this issue, as well as many, many others that are facing Illinoisans. IllinoisRightToLife.org, IllinoisRightToLife.org. Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. For the remainder of this hour and into the next, I have a question that I need your answer to. You remember yesterday we were talking about what's the real face of Islam? Let's say for the sake of argument that we take that question and just put it on the back burner. Is the Muslim and the Islamic religion at its heart the genesis of terrorism, or is it the genesis of tolerance and all those things that we hold near and dear, freedom, tolerance, and open-mindedness? Let's take that question for a moment, put it on the back burner. That's what we talked about yesterday. It remains there, but let's put it on the back burner. It's voting time. November is near. Let's say it's a primary. And there are several candidates who are vying for a state office, a federal office. And nothing that I'm going to say here is really out of the realm of possibility. This is not far-fetched at all. I need your answer to this question. Two candidates Candidate A, a pro-life, anti-homosexual, that is anti-gay marriage, Republican, who happens to be a Muslim. Candidate B, a pro-choice, pro-homosexual Republican. Say, like, you don't have to search far to find one of these, especially on the national scene. Good old Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York. Pro-choice, pro-homosexual, Republican. He's even a Roman Catholic. He's a Christian. Colin Powell, for that matter, also fits this description pretty well as anybody else. These two candidates, candidate A, the pro-life, anti-homosexual Republican who's a Muslim, and the pro-choice, pro-homosexual Republican who's a Christian. Who do you vote for? Who do you vote for? I want your answer to that question during Open Lines. It's for the remainder of this hour, the next 10 minutes, and into the next hour. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I want your answer to that question, especially in light of what we talked about yesterday. The insight that Dr. John Warwick Montgomery brought to the program. We played a little bit of sound from him from way back in 2001, a mere 2 weeks after September 11th, 2001. Dr. Montgomery observed that Muslims, when in the minority, the political minority, especially in the West, are often peace-loving and tolerant. When Muslims are in the political majority, you often find a very different face, a very different tenor to that religion as it manifests itself. Okay, in light of that, who do you vote for? Candidate A, the pro-life, anti-homosexual, Republican Muslim, or the pro-choice, pro-homosexual, Republican Christian? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. And as so many of the questions here on Issues, Etc., this may be hypothetical now, but I can guarantee you it won't be in the future. Sooner or later, you will be faced with a choice like this. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Rich is calling from his car. Rich, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, hello. When you mentioned that, I'd vote for the Muslim in a heartbeat.
And let's explore a bit, if we could, Rich. Why?
Well, you know, the government is not a Christian government. It happens to be a government with Christians in it. But, you know, the people who are elected to fulfill civil functions and understanding the Lutheran distinction of the two kingdoms, whoever I believe that can fulfill the particular function, the civil functions best, that would be the person whom I would vote for. You know, if the person happened to be a Muslim, so be it.
All right, now, I understand your answer there, Rich, and your answer is obviously one that's made on the basis of kind of a sound understanding of the difference between the two kingdoms, God's civil realm and sacred realm. It's made on the basis of a kind of a dispassionate understanding of what government is really for, and I understand all of that. But given what's happening today, the world today, and given the insight from Dr. Montgomery yesterday, where when in the political majority Islam takes on a different character, would that give you any qualms about voting for the Muslim?
Well, you know, if things had, you know, if the political climate perhaps were different where, you know, our government was becoming Islamicized, perhaps I might look at it differently. That certainly isn't the case now. And, you know, I look at the, at least right now, the great moral divide is really, you know, whether the right to life or protecting life, and I would choose in that direction, even if the person were a Muslim.
Rich, thank you so much. Very lucid first caller there, answering the question, who would you vote for, the pro-life, anti-homosexual Republican who is a Muslim, or the pro-choice, pro-homosexual Republican who is a Christian? Who would you vote for? What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, this is... And Rich is right. This is not the kind of case if the government were becoming, or if the nation were becoming Islamicized, a new term we've got now, which Rich wasn't the first one to use it. If that were the case, then he might think twice. But here in America, that's not the case. And that's true. Muslims are still by and large, a small, one might even say minuscule minority in the United States. But they are growing worldwide in terms of their numbers. And especially given the fact that in the Western world, population growth is not at replacement levels, but in the Muslim world, it's well above replacement levels, maintenance. There's actually positive population growth there. They have more babies, right? Nothing against them. God love them for having more babies. Now, if you were in Germany or Great Britain with significantly larger Muslim populations, where they're not just insignificant minorities in terms of their political clout, but they are now significant minorities. Now, maybe Europe and Great Britain are the shape of things to come here in America. If Islam continues to grow worldwide, if the influx, think about it, it's not altogether pleasant to be a Muslim in a Muslim nation. A lot of them leave to come over here. And welcome to you. But they come, they emigrate to come over here for education, for jobs, for freedom. We are the beacon of freedom, aren't we? But with every Muslim that comes, again, the minority grows. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Gary's calling from his car. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with the last caller there and vote for the Muslim, partly because he still has to operate within our framework of government, kind of as he said. And the other side of that is, what has that other candidate's Christianity done to affect his life? If he's for killing babies and doesn't recognize the moral implications of homosexuality.
Well, that's a good question. Thank you, Gary. Now, see, let's use Rudolph Giuliani as kind of our example of candidate B. At this point, I don't know of any candidate A, but there's going to be one out there. There will be, and I think probably within the next quarter century, it would be safe to say far more and more every day. Appearing on the ballot locally, statewide, nationally, Muslims who are Republican, pro-life, anti-gay marriage. Let's take Rudolph Giuliani. That's candidate A. So we don't have a name for him. But Rudolph Giuliani fits the bill, or Colin Powell, for that matter, fits the bill for candidate B. Pro-choice, maybe mildly, but still pro-choice. Pro-homosexual, perhaps hedging his bets on that one too, but still pro-homosexual. Republican and Christian. Okay, we've asked the question about John Kerry. What in his Christian faith is having any effect in his life? So let's say he's not consistently a Christian. Fine. That's really the question about the Muslim, isn't it? Turn the question upside down. The man who stands there and says, I am pro-life, I am against gay marriage, I'm a Republican, and I'm a Muslim. The question that one that is really behind all of this is he a consistent Muslim? No surprise that Christians aren't consistent in the way they vote, especially our lawmakers. I mean, there's so many examples, we can't even name them all. But the Muslim, yes, he has to operate within the framework of American law. Yes, he has to operate within the framework of the balance of powers and everything like that. Just because a Muslim is elected to a federal office, Senate, House, even president, doesn't mean we'll all be wearing headscarves tomorrow. Of course not. But is he a consistent Muslim? In other words, if in the political majority, will the face of Islam change? Yes, there are some struggling but simple democracies in the Muslim world. But by and large, Muslim states are not democracies. Religious freedom under a religion that does not recognize a distinction, much less a separation between church and state, religious freedom is dismissed out of hand. Okay, we've heard from two men. What about the women? Women vote too. In fact, if the polls are right, women are voting more than men are. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You've heard two callers who say that they would vote for the Muslim over against the Christian in this hypothetical showdown between candidate A and candidate B. What about the rest of you? Does anyone disagree? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the last couple weeks, as you have observed, and let's go back not just weeks, but months, as you have observed what can prevail in a country where Muslims rule, and what can happen there, has it made you wonder from time to time, could I vote for a Muslim? Should I vote for a Muslim? I'm not trying to incite any kind of prejudice against Muslims. I'm not. I am asking a question that we will sooner or later deal with here. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, calling from her car, Jane is on the line. Jane, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I wouldn't vote for either one of them, nor would I vote for the Democratic Party.
What would you do?
Probably try to find another party to help promote if there was, you know, if there was a difference. Because of listening to John, and I listened to him a long time ago when he did this, and have heard other people, you know, say the same thing. And I imagine in Detroit, they already have maybe some elections that they could be dealing with locally.
Jane, thank you so much. And I think even with the breaking up phone there, we got the point. She mentioned Detroit. Now, there we go. There we go. Start of something big, maybe, in Detroit. The Detroit area, especially around Dearborn, thereabouts, has the largest Muslim population of any urban center, percentage-wise. It's not a majority, but it's a very large Muslim population. Pakistani, Afghani, Iranian, Iraqi, Muslims from all over the Muslim world flock there to Detroit. I don't know why, but they do. And, you know, the more that flock there, the more that will flock there. They want to go and be, they don't want to be in the microscopic minority. They want to find a place where, yes, we'll be the minority. Would you? I mean, if you immigrated to another country, you go where people of your own religious background and cultural background are to feel more at home. I don't know for sure, but I imagine that in Detroit, there are lawmakers who fit the bill for Canada Day. Republican, pro-life, anti-gay marriage, Muslim. Remember the story we did just recently here on Issues, Etc. about the city council, I think it was, that wanted to change a noise ordinance in West Dearborn, someplace like that near Detroit, a suburb, to allow at 5 o'clock in the morning before the sun comes up, the sounding of the call to prayer from the mosques in the Detroit area. Yes. Open lines 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.